The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains just a single grain. But if it dies, it yields a rich harvest. Each of us has undergone and will yet undergo countless passions, deaths, and resurrections. In churches, yes, but also in hospitals and office buildings, by bedsides and firesides, under the open sky, and around kitchen tables. As beings fashioned in the image of our Creator, we are equipped to experience moments of love so deep we can barely breathe. Yet, as finite creatures, the sacrifice such love may ask of us introduces our hearts to a vast and unfamiliar landscape that can be, frankly, terrifying. We hear the words, "I love you," "I do," "I will," with God's help, words on our own lips, drawn from our depths by an invisible and loving hand. As we grow into the sacrifice of love, we find ourselves making choices that require a courage we never imagined possible. Helping a parent die, raising a child with cancer, going on a first job interview after months of unemployment, publicly professing a vowed commitment that will change everything. On the precipice of such moments, we are certain we will come completely undone, yet our hearts burn with a brighter clarity of intention. And as we watch others on the brink of undergoing these passions, these deaths, these resurrections, there is no doubt in our hearts what we are watching. We catch a glimpse of the glorification of God in women and men at the moment their hour has come. But there are other moments when our hour approaches and we cannot bear it. Not now, not yet, not this way, we tell ourselves. At the moment of self-offering, our trembling hearts close, the moment fades, but God waits always for the next opportunity to send an angel to wait in ambush, or a group of strangers with a surprising request. "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." There is one particular orientation of the heart that I believe is crucial for us as followers of Jesus, called to respond at ever deeper levels of our being to the gift of his life in us. We see Jesus model this disposition for us as he announces, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified." In the midst of struggle, we see in Jesus the courage to choose vulnerability. Willingly accepted vulnerability prepares the ground of our hearts to say yes at that hour when God invites us into our own glorification, which is also his glorification in us. Here in John's 12th chapter, a chapter that acts as a crucial hinge in the overall structure of this gospel, we hear Jesus offer several juxtapositions. A grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies. By its death, it yields a rich harvest. Anyone who loves his life loses it. Anyone who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. Whoever serves me must follow me. If anyone serves me, my Father will honor him. And finally, we are presented with the crux of the matter, a question and an answer that most meaningfully express Jesus' glorious vulnerability. "Now, my soul is troubled. What shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? But it is for this reason that I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name." In this moment, we see a tension at play in Jesus. There is the very real, very human desire to protect himself and to avoid suffering. And there is the equally real conviction that his most authentic personal response to the divine initiative is to embrace the mystery, to embrace the mysterious and generative power at work in the very midst of suffering vulnerability. We live in a culture that avoids vulnerability at almost all costs, yet suffers dramatically from the attendant feelings of disconnection, isolation, and unworthiness that are the obvious symptoms of our obsession with invulnerability. Jesus models an entirely different path through life into the glory that God intends. He soberly acknowledges his options. Shall I say, Father, save me from this hour? He seems to see in this choice a false craving for an inauthentic self-preservation that would deny his reason for being and relinquish his hour. Instead, he makes an impossibly risky and deeply vulnerable choice that rings with truth. His consent to the hour that has come, with all its dreadful implications and inevitable consequences, is followed by a cry of deep trust in God and a surrender of control. It is for this reason that I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name. So at this point, you might be thinking, yeah, but he's Jesus. Do you really expect me to do that? That is some kind of spiritual jiu-jitsu. Maybe. But you're already doing it. You're doing it right now. Liturgical worship is one of the best dress rehearsals for these moments in life. So I'll invite you to step outside the frame of our well-trodden collects for a moment to remember what I'm willing to bet you already know intuitively, that liturgy at its best, disarms us in order to let more of God in to us. According to liturgical scholar James Farwell, Christian liturgy is marked by highly significant binaries that symbolically deploy the binaries and paradoxical imagery we find in the Gospels. In the push and pull between these binaries, a generative tension emerges that produces meaning. So a simple example we're all familiar with is the binary bread and wine on the one hand and body and blood on the other hand. The elision of these two binaries in the mystical unity of the sacrament yields a meaning that is inexhaustible no matter how many times we encounter it. Examples of these binaries multiply exponentially. Our God weeps tears and dies. But he is the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world who wipes away every tear. Christ is the only one worthy, whose sacrifice is all sufficient. Yet in him we are little Christs, and our sacrificial participation in his worthiness makes us worthy. The juxtapositions here are meant to disturb and startle, to loosen the rust and melt the ice encasing our hearts, encasing our understandings of God and ourselves. But it is the cross that presents us with the crowning, climactic binary, and nowhere is this more true than in the Gospel of John. In John, the cross becomes a true paradox, a collision of apparent opposites with the power to transfigure our perception. Scholar Richard Baucom notes that for the Johannine community, the paradox of the cross, honor in humiliation, visible splendor in disfigurement and death,